It's six-ish on Sunday night, and true stories is my topic for tonight's Sharon Hour, just starting. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. First one that caught my eye comes from a story in the New York Times about a man, Nick Burchill, who was christened the worst hotel guest ever by a particular hotel, the Fairmont Empress in Canada, from where he was banned for life. It centres round a rather benign act on his part, but the result was catastrophic. What he did was he left a suitcase filled with pepperoni in his hotel room. It was a specific Canadian pepperoni, a hot one, that he was going to take back to his sales office to treat a conference room full of people that were hosting his new employer. In celebration of his new employer, he'd promised to bring everyone back this local delicacy, a specific pepperoni called Crisp Brothers TNT pepperoni. He said, "I brought enough for a ship." But when he landed, the airline couldn't find his bag full of pepperoni. They promised to search for it, and they did, and finally found it and delivered it to the Fairmont Empress after he'd checked in. His room had no refrigerator, and he worried about how to keep the pepperoni cool. So what he did was he opened the window in his room, and he spread the meat out on the windowsill to keep it cool. And then he made his fatal mistake. He went for a walk. The sight that greeted him when he returned to his room hours later, writes Yonette Joseph, the New York Times reporter of this story about the invasion of the seagulls into this man's hotel room that I'm repeating on tonight's KX935's The Sharon Hour, could only be described as an explosion. About 40 seagulls had sneaked in through the open window and were having a feast. And the reason this specific Crisp Brothers TNT pepperoni is germane to the story is it's really hot and does nasty things to a seagull's digestive system. And the seagulls had been eating it for about 5 hours. He said the smell in the room was overwhelming from the excrement around the room. Plus there were feathers and pepperoni chunks littered over everything. And he said what was shocking was the saliva. Mr. Burchill, the propagator of this disaster, said, "I didn't know seagulls drooled. The slime was covering everything. They'd been whipping the pepperoni up into the air, and it was like a tornado." When he suddenly arrived in his room, he startled the birds, which tried to leave but kept crashing into the lamps and the curtains, spewing feathers everywhere. Nick Burchill said most people would have probably called housekeeping, but he decided he'd try to take back his room himself. He said he opened all the windows to let the birds out, but then when they tried to return, he hurled a shoe at them, a shoe which sailed out of the window along with the bird, and then he flung a bath towel over another bird who had come in and didn't want to go out. He said, "I'd forgotten seagulls can't fly when they're wrapped in a towel." He said tourists were lined up beneath his window watching the chaos of the birds flying off, and both the wrapped up seagull and the towel and the shoe landed on top of them. He said that wasn't the end of it. He was in a rush to get to this dinner where he was supposed to surprise everyone with the pepperoni. So he quickly raced down, got his shoe, washed it off, but then jammed a hairdryer into it to dry it. Then the phone rang, and while he was out of the bathroom answering the phone, the hairdryer vibrated itself free from the shoe, fell into the sink, which was full of water from him washing the shoe, and knocked out all the power. Finally, he did summon housekeeping. He said, I can still remember the look on the housekeeper's face when she opened the door. He said, I had absolutely no idea what to tell her, so I just said, sorry, and I went to dinner. People asked him why he didn't call for help straight away, and he said, I just thought I could handle it. He ultimately got a letter from the management sent to his company stating in no uncertain terms that he was never, ever to set foot in that hotel again. You can just imagine the cleanup costs, let alone anything else. A couple of decades later, Mr. Burchill put a plea in Facebook for the hotel to pardon him, and apparently it unleashed an outpouring of empathetic responses and essays on forgiveness. The public reaction was so overwhelming that the Fairmont Empress Hotel were impressed enough by his letter begging forgiveness that they said okay, that the ban was lifted. Mr. Burchill said he got a phone call from a manager telling him that his letter absolutely made their week and that he was welcome again should he wish to come. Mr. Burchill said, it's probably because the whole world is so stressed out right now that this touched a nerve and let everybody have a laugh. Part of his peace offering to the hotel staff was to offer them a pound of Brothers TNT pepperoni. The manager responded that he, Mr. Burchill, and his family were welcome to come stay, with the proviso that he not bring any pepperoni and not open any hotel windows. I think that's a lovely story.
Birds can fly so high, or they can on your head, yeah, they can must fly into your eye and make you feel so scared. But when you look at them and you see that they're beautiful, that's how I feel about you. But birds can fly so high, and they can on your head, yeah, they can almost fly into your eye and make you feel well scared. But when you look at them and you see that they're beautiful, that's how I feel about you. Yeah, that's how I feel about you. She said, what? He said, you. She said, what are you talking about? He said, you. Can fly so high on the cat on your head, yeah, they can almost fly into your eye and make you feel so scared. But when you look at them and you see that they're beautiful, that's how I feel about you. Right, birds can fly so high, or they can on your head, yeah, they can almost fly into your eye and make you feel well scared. But when you look at them and you see that they're beautiful, that's how I feel about you. That's how I feel about you. She said, thanks.
This is the Sharon Hour on Lagunas KX935. I'm Sharon James, and I'm telling true stories tonight as my theme. The next one is also one that involves a torturous situation that is also funny, so long as you didn't have to participate in it. This one is also by Yonette Joseph, along with Palko Karas, and also from the New York Times. And it involves a small Dutch village where drivers were continually veering onto the shoulder. So what officials did is, instead of putting rumble strips, they put musical strips along the shoulder so that whenever a car did veer too far over, the musical strip played the regional anthem of this local province, the Friesland province. This was the brainwave of Sitski Popius, who's the vice governor of the Friesland province. And this village of Jelsum was chosen as an experiment to see if it was something that would work for the whole province. And since Jelsum was close to the provincial capital of Leeuwarden, which actually was named the European Capital of Culture for this year, that made it a good place to experiment. It was also because this particular road, the N357, was long and straight and had a new surface. She said this wasn't just some whimsical novelty thing. People go on the shoulder quite a bit because they're distracted when they're on the road. And we also wanted to see how the paint was keeping up when they went onto the shoulder. So this musical alert, I guess, was helpful for that too. And she thought, since we're a newly anointed cultural capital of Europe, let's make a cultural event out of this safety precaution. Now, the Friesland province, though part of the Netherlands, actually has its own language. They don't speak Dutch there, they speak Frisian. So what they did is they painted on part of the regional anthem titled De Oude Friesen, the Old Frisians. It's an anthem from the 19th century. It cost about 80,000 euros, or about 100 grand US, to do this. Then they had a sign telling drivers, "You are approaching a singing road." When drivers hit around 38 miles an hour, the regional anthem then rang out loud and clear. But if they wandered onto the shoulder at a lower speed, it was worse than going at high speed, because the shoulder would then play like a slow playing record. And if you happened to back up onto the shoulder, the vice governor said, it would be like a Madonna record playing backwards, because it was basically vinyl on the road. Just like you have grooves on a record, there were vinyl grooves on the road. Anyway, the poor local villagers were soon complaining that it was impossible to sleep. They said, okay, the Frisian national anthem is fine, but not 24 hours a day. Imagine hearing that over and over again. You might be praying for jackhammers. You're listening to The Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James, telling true stories today, and this is the true story of a musical strip painted on the road in a little village in the Netherlands, so that when motorists inadvertently veered onto the shoulder, the regional anthem, the Friesland regional anthem, would play. This one poor villager, who lived about 600 feet from the road, said, I'm going nuts. You can't sit outside and you can't sleep at night. Now, this is in a village where the villagers are accustomed to noise because there's an airbase where fighter jets regularly take off and land. But everyone said, I'd rather have those fighter jets than this. At least they stop at 5 p.m. This musical road is psychological torture. Miss Popies, the vice governor of the province, said she'd visited the village to hear the complaints because they didn't want to upset the villagers. They wanted them to be on board with the project. She said all they said was, okay, it's working, but please don't make it work here. Basically, they hated it. They said drivers were deliberately veering onto the shoulder to start the anthem. Enthusiastic young people who were driving way too fast. He said, unfortunately, it's been wonderful weather, so everyone's sitting in their gardens. That's what we call backyards in Europe. So they couldn't switch off to the noise. Anyway, it took 2 days for those strips that had been laid down for 100 grand to be scraped off overnight. Actually, believe it or not, here in the US, we also have one on a section of Route 66 in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It plays America the Beautiful. And in Lancaster, California, there's a stretch of desert highway that apparently plays Rossini's William Tell Overture when drivers hit 55 miles per hour, but it's woefully out of tune because the grooves in the road weren't installed at the right distance from each other, so the sound is completely distorted. In Japan, there are musical rumble strips near Mount Fuji. They've tried it too in South Korea, and one of them plays an off-key version of Mary Had a Little Lamb. But Denmark claims credit for the first known one, called the asphaltophone. Miss Popius said, even though this particular experiment in this particular village didn't work, they haven't totally given up. She said, we're just in a cool down period. If we do it again, we'll make sure nobody in the neighborhood is too bothered by it. It just wasn't a good idea in the end. Well, that last verse doesn't really make any sense, does it? And worse, imagine it played off-key every time your car veered onto a rumble strip. You're tuned to the Sharon Hour on Laguna's KX935. I'm Sharon James, telling true stories tonight. Some funny, some very sad and poignant, like this next one. Again, this story was reported in the New York Times by Jeffrey Mays. And it's about a lawyer, David Buckle, who was known nationally for championing gay rights. But in this case, he was acting out against the pollution of the earth. And how he did it, horrifically, was he self-immolated. His remains were found in a field near baseball diamonds and a loop used by joggers and bikers. This was in Brooklyn, New York. And the note he left exhorted people to lead less selfish lives as a way to protect the planet. He left the note in a shopping cart a short distance from his immolated body. He also emailed it to several news media outlets, including the New York Times. In his life, he'd been the lead attorney in a suit against a Nebraska County sheriff who'd been found liable for failing to protect Brandon Tina. He was the transgendered man whom Hilary Swank portrayed in the film Boys Don't Cry. She actually won an Academy Award for it. You'll remember Brandon Tina was murdered for being transsexual in this little town of Falls City, Nebraska. David Buckle was also the strategist between important same-sex marriage cases before he became involved in environmental causes. In the email he wrote to the Times to be published after his death, he wrote, "Most humans on the planet now breathe the air made unhealthy by fossil fuels. Many die early deaths as a result. My early death by fossil fuel reflects what we are doing to ourselves. Pollution ravages our planet, oozing inhabitability via air, soil, water, and weather." He wrote that donating to organizations wasn't enough. He said he himself was privileged with good health to the final moment, but he wanted his death to lead to increased action. He said, "Honorable purpose in life invites honorable purpose in death." You are tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. telling true stories on tonight's show, funny ones and sad ones. This is a sad one about one David Buckle, a man who self-immolated in order to protest what we're doing to the planet and ourselves on it. Certainly an extreme demonstration, right? In his life, as I said before, he was a champion of environmental causes. He was extremely active in fighting for gay, lesbian, and transgender rights. He spearheaded the case Nabotsky versus Podlensny, which resulted in the first time a federal court ruled that schools have an obligation to prevent the bullying of gay students. He led another case that ruled that same-sex couples and their children were harmed by being excluded from the right to marry, and he was very active in all green causes. People were dumbfounded by the way he chose to express his outrage by his own death, leaving a blackened patch in a green park brimming with activity. Joggers and young baseball players and soccer and volleyball players and people barbecuing. A very strange way to die for a cause, but a noble life, and obviously he felt severely challenged by what needed to be done to shock people into making things better. It's such a hard balance to strike, isn't it? It's good that we care, but if we care too much, it becomes too much for us. The world is too unjust and there are so many honourable causes. There's no question we need to protect our planet and all of us attempting to live fair and just lives within it. But it can become unbearable when we have to consider so many factors. It's hard to know which things to fight, how much fight we can give to them, and how likely we are to win. And we need allies. We need whole swaths of people to feel the same way about certain things that we do. When it comes to the natural world, you might be surprised to know, I was surprised to know, that trees are in fact very much like us, and the society trees form with each other, communicating with their own chemical language transmitted from root to root, is not dissimilar from our society. Trees form neighbourhood watch committees, for example, with rapid response networks that alert others if there's a threatening intruder. According to a book recently written by Richard Powers called The Overstory, and its recent review in The Times by Barbara King-Solver, trees manage their resources in bank accounts, even using past market trends to predict future needs. They mine and farm the land, and sometimes they move their families across great distances in order to get them better opportunities. All things we do too. Trees just do it more slowly. It might take them what takes us decades, centuries. Then again, most established trees have far longer lifespans than we do. Still, just as we do, they compete for their livelihoods. They take care of their families. They can make huge sacrifices for their children. They breathe. They eat, they have sex, they give gifts, they learn things and remember things and record important events of their lives. And for all that, we treat them as tables and chairs and floors and ceiling beams. We cut them down at whim after all their hard labours. So as if we don't have enough injustices to worry about in a world of human beings, we have to worry about the plant world too, and obviously, the magnitude of all of that was too much for this noble warrior, David Buckle. Even the Beach Boys, who don't usually write about anything on land, were inspired. Here's an uncharacteristic song they wrote about trees.
Sky, a nest. I sat was rich and I was strong. From seed to tree I grew so tall. Through wind and rain I could not fall. But now my branches suffer and my leaves don't offer poetry to men of song. Trees like me weren't meant to live if all this world can give pollution.
Not usually what we expect from the Beach Boys, right? That was their sad song called A Day in the Life of a Tree, played for you tonight on this The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. I'm telling two stories tonight, and I believe them to be true because they come from a very accredited newspaper, the New York Times. This next one by Candace Pyers is equally sad and funny and poignant. It's about a wedding ceremony between two homeless people. For most couples, what happened at the outset might have ruined the day, but this couple is used to hardship. What happened was both the bride's dress and the groom's suit were stolen. But the bride is used to this because she lives in a tent on the side of a parking lot in the south of Seattle, a few minutes from downtown. And she said things get taken all the time out here. But a local resident and volunteer, who's now become a friend to the couple, stepped in with clothes for both the bride and the groom, clothes of his own, plus he drove the couple to a Goodwill store where they chose new clothes. The bride and groom met 6 years ago under the King Street station clock in Seattle. He'd arrived from Arizona for Seattle's annual Hemp Fest, and the bride had told him she had some marijuana to sell him, so he gave her $10. She said at the time she was addicted to crack and she stole his money, but that didn't put him off. After asking her to hang out, they spent a few hours together at a laundromat. The bride said, "The thing I remember most was his smell. It still makes me feel whooshy now." The bride had been adopted at birth. She said her biological father was not cool with her and her biological mother was a dope fiend. Her adoptive parents lived in a very remote part of Alaska with no roads. Her mother was the president of the newspaper and her father the president of an oil company. "So I was raised by a good family," she said. "I even had a nanny, but I wasn't spoiled. I was never yelled at by my mom and dad. They never spanked me. But still, I had a rough life, including being sexually abused by her grandfather. Her only brother died from a drug overdose. She herself had dreams of being a veterinarian. But she was introduced to, quote, life outside her sheltered upbringing when she was 18. She said, "I went buck wild and told my parents, 'You can't tell me what to do no more.' And it was at this point that she met a man who introduced her to crack. That led to a 30-year addiction.
Cocaine. Thank you.
If cocaine is as hypnotic and addictive as that music, it's small wonder that people can't kick it, eh? You're tuned to the Sharon Hour on Lunas KX935. And my topic tonight is true stories. The true story I'm in the process of telling was reported in the vows section of the New York Times about a homeless couple getting married. She's a 5-time married crack cocaine addict who has managed to stay clean for nearly 3 months, enough time to plan this 6th wedding that, let's pray, will last. They have been together 6 years so far, through thick and thin. He's a once previously married father of 10 who likes living outdoors, even moved into a tent in his own backyard while he was parenting after his first wife had died because he couldn't bear to be inside their marital home. As for his new bride-to-be, the recovering crack addict, she had moved to Seattle 30 years ago and has been mainly homeless since. She's been married 5 times and has 8 grown children, one in Seattle, the others, including 2 sets of twins, in Anchorage. She said, "They're all being taken care of. It doesn't make me a bad person. I'm not." Her groom said he never used hard drugs, just smoked weed and drunk beer. He'd only been married once before she died. They'd had 10 children. Still, he said, after her death, he put a tent in the backyard and slept outdoors, much to the confusion of his children. He says he still owns that 5-bedroom Phoenix property. His daughters live there. He explained, "I'm really not homeless. I could leave Los Angeles, where he now lives, any time." And he does miss his children. But he said, "This way, I just don't worry about anything." He's led a transient life for years at this point, and he tells his kids all the time, after he's visited them, "Pop's got to go." He said, "I did my bit. I raised them well." He has 4 sons, 2 in the Army, 1 in the Marine, 1 in the Navy, and all his 6 daughters are nurses. For his bride, the morning of their wedding marked 84 days clean from crack cocaine for her. She said it's the first time she stopped using the drugs, and she never would have done it if it wasn't for him. She said, "It was really hard, and it's still really hard, but knowing that I'm loved and that I've got somebody with me has made it possible."
You could be liking it too.
You are tuned to the Sharon Hour on Lagunas KX 935. I'm Sharon James, telling true stories tonight. And this is one of two people living on the streets who fell in love and just got married. And they have no great plans to change their lives. They just want to love each other and help each other. The groom is trying to help the bride get off cocaine. He said, "Do you want that dope or do you want me?" He promised that if she was willing to try to quit, he'd help her through it. He said, "I believed in her and she believed in me." And she's at this point clean. She has an apprenticeship at Native Works, where she's paid $14 an hour to make jewelry. It's a company affiliated with the Chief Seattle Club, where she also helps other homeless Native Americans. She said she was raised by her father to always help others. And the groom says of her, "This woman would take the jacket that she's wearing and give it to anyone. And my mother was the same way. She used to feed the street people before she fed us." I have to interject here that this problem of homelessness seems to be getting so much worse. And it's really hard to deal with it, mainly because of NIMBYism, which is totally understandable. We want the homeless to be taken care of, but we don't want encampments around us. Eric Garcetti has just been trying to clean up LA from the sort of various tent cities that are lining the sidewalks. He says, after we've cleared them and washed them down, they just come back, and then we clear them and wash them down again, but we can't do that endlessly. They have passed a bond in Los Angeles to raise money to house the homeless, and so there's money there. It's just having the neighborhood residents agree to homeless housing on their streets. I had a friend tell me she recently went to one of those Korean spas downtown Los Angeles. They're open all through the night. For $25, apparently, you can have treatments and even spend the night there. There are steam rooms that are 146 degrees. Insane, if you want them, though. And, of course, the regular scrub downs. And it occurred to me that maybe you could open a whole lot of these treatment spas and the homeless could spend the night there and get a scrub down. Maybe that's completely naive of me, but it's a thought, right? I had an interview where a woman said, "You know, we're not all drug addicts, like this bride-to-be," it said. She said, "We just have gotten used to living on the streets in these communities." And the thing is, I think most stable people want a more stable life than that, but a lot of these people have emotional issues. One of these women interviewed who said she'd been on the streets for a while said she'd gotten evicted from where she was living, and because she has this eviction notice, nobody will allow her to rent. Now, whether she got evicted because her behavior was impossible or because she couldn't pay the rent, I don't know. I do know that since Ronald Reagan closed down all the mental health facilities, this has hugely exacerbated the homeless problem. And I still don't quite understand why that was done, other than these marginalized, disenfranchised people aren't voters. So it was a callous act because they're considered constituents who don't count. But I don't think those of us who value our own lives imagine ourselves on the streets. And it must be horrifying to find yourself there.
All I see is road. No one takes me home. Where can I? Truth about desire, they say, is a need to breathe for another day. Truth I heard about regret is the hardest truth I've come to yet. It's the hardest truth I've come to yet. Late at night, he'll come to me and he'll tell me I'm alone. Don't you think I don't already? All I hear was, there's something I don't know. Where can I? All I see is rough. No one takes me home. Where?
up your gulp and jump for Rosie. She's just a sweet thing with a curve, just about a woman with her clothes on. You take them off and she's a girl. All I hear a word. There's something I don't know. Where can I?
You're tuned to the Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. I'm telling true stories tonight, funny ones, poignant ones. The one I'm currently telling involves two homeless people who are getting married. The bride-to-be has been married several times. She comes from a good adoptive home, but ended up on the streets. The groom still has a family home that his daughters now live in. He actually moved into the backyard and out of the house after his wife had died because he couldn't bear to be inside the family home. He pitched a tent in his own backyard. This was back in Seattle. Now he's pitching it amongst the homeless on the streets of Los Angeles. By choice, it sounds like. Maybe he just got used to living with nothing and being outside. Though there are practical challenges of living on the street. But the bride said, "It's made them closer. He does everything for me. He makes sure I eat and that I've got clothes on my back. He paints my toenails. He says whatever she wants, I'll do it." Not that the relationship hasn't had its challenges. The groom has a construction job he works at every day, 8 hours a day. But the bride said, every time he got a paycheck, I'd lie to him and steal from him. The groom doesn't mind. He said he knew he could always make more money and he still loved her. He said he proposed to her this past February because, quote, "I can trust her."
Don't trust her, never trust her, won't trust her, won't trust me. X's on the back of your hands, wash them in the bathroom to drink like the bands. And set list, you stole off the stage, had red and purple lipstick all over the page. Bruises. Cover your arms, shaking in the fingers with a bottle in your palm. And the best is, no one knows who you are. Just another girl alone at the bar.
She wants to touch me, whoa. She wants to love me, whoa. She'll never leave me, whoa.
Shut your lips, do the Helen Keller, and talk with your hips. I said, shush, girl, shut your lips, do the Helen Keller, and talk with your hips.
She wants to touch me. She wants to love me, woo. She'll never leave me, woo, 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 woo.
Don't trust her, never trust her. Won't trust her, won't trust me.
She wants to touch me, woo. She wants to love me, woo. She'll never leave me, woo, 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 woo.
Don't trust her, never trust her. Won't trust her, won't trust me.
You are tuned to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, telling true stories tonight. And this is the story of a recently married couple who live on the streets. They've just gotten used to it. Neither of them really has to. The groom has a large 5-bedroom home in Phoenix where his daughters now live. And this past Thanksgiving, the bride took him to visit her family in Alaska, where he said the family house is so huge there are helicopter pads in the backyard. He impressed her parents by making goose for dinner. Of course, when you're homeless, you don't have a kitchen at your disposal. But a small walk from where the couple now live in a street tent, there's something that the homeless people call the Rainier Pop-Up Kitchen, where a group of 20 local residents feed the homeless on Sundays, do Sunday lunch. Apparently the group got giddy when the couple told them that they were getting married. He said, "We've been having email and Facebook threads to plan the day." Volunteers also regularly bring dinners for the homeless, setting up folding tables and chairs on the sidewalk by the busy road under an Interstate 90 bridge where they live. One of the volunteers who feeds them says, "The bride's a lot of fun because she'll always tell you what she thinks, and the groom's a really cool guy who loves to talk about the 60s. The couple were married by one of those local volunteers who's an associate dean at the City University of Seattle. She ordained herself in the Universal Life Church. Other volunteers decorated a gazebo frame with blue and white paper garlands and strings of battery-powered lights for the wedding. There were new white tablecloths, tea lights, boutonnieres, and flowers abounded, and there was sparkling cider to toast the newly married couple. Just before the ceremony, the groom asked the bride if she had cold feet, saying, "I've got some hand warmers you could put in your boots if you do." They had a little flower girl, a 2-year-old who also lives with her parents in one of the tents. One of the volunteers who'd made the wedding cake had to stand in for the maid of honor who'd been injured by a camping fire the night before, a frequent hazard in homeless camps, and something the volunteers try to control by donating fire extinguishers to the community. As the couple said their vows, passing cars honked, guests blew bubbles, and afterwards the couple danced to the song Always and Forever, played over portable speakers.
Every day, love tell me you really care and we'll share tomorrow together.
And just picture them dancing to that in the middle of the street. Can't you, listener? The best man, who's also homeless, said, "When you're homeless and you're in a relationship, it gets real, real serious. It can be unbearable sometimes. She might be hungry when you're not. She needs coffee, but it's dark outside. You don't know where the meal is coming from. But if you can go through that with an individual, that's love." The bride said, "It's hard for me to be happy, but with this man, I am." We all think we need so many things to be happy, don't we? But really, we just need food, water, and love. And of course, a roof above our heads, ideally a substantial one. So she says, "I realize what a hypocrite I am saying that. I just packed for a trip to London, and I had in my head an image of a pristine suitcase with just two or three things. And then you think, well, I need something if it gets colder than I think it's going to be. I need sweaters. And then I need things if it's warmer than anticipated. And then being London, I need a change of things if it gets wet. I need to have different shoes if it gets wet. I need shoes for walking, and then I need shoes for looking a bit smarter. I need one outfit in case I need to look smart, at least. And not having laundry facilities when I'm gone, I need changes of things. And then I have the computer, and then I need a converter plug, and I need all the adapters, and I need all the battery chargers, and it's insane. And still, I think I'm being minimalistic, so, as I said, hypocritical, but it's a lovely idea that you can just subsist on a little bit of food and a lot of love. I'm referring, of course, to that last story in my show about true stories, in tonight's Share an Hour dedicated to true stories about real people in real situations. If you want to hear them again, go to iTunes or to our dedicated website, kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. And I also quickly want to mention that we're all very excited here at KX935 about the new sign coming into Laguna Beach, alerting everyone to the existence of this radio station that we hope all you Lagunans are a member of. And if not, please do become a member of. It's Laguna's one and only listener-supported, member-supported public FM radio station. We aim to keep you entertained 24/7. This, the Sharon Now and me, Sharon James, is just one of around 50 shows that we have. Some informative, some music only, some a combination. Plus, we organize local concerts and other fun events. So check out our website, kx935.com. Become a member. And if you're not a local resident here in Laguna, we encourage you to get our app and listen to KX935 Live online. Meanwhile, this is Sharon James of the Sharon Hour, wishing you a great week ahead.